Today on Against the Grain, how can we manage to think about and move toward a better world in the bleakest of times? I'm Sasha Lilly, Argentinian critical theorist. Anna Cecilia Dinnerstein joins me to talk about capitalism, the state, and our own collective power. She'll also discuss the tradition of open Marxism and why we might want to be skeptical of a universal basic income, which has supporters on both left and right. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Capitalism is a system hardwired for crisis, as the events of the last several months have reminded us. Yet even before COVID-19, our world was beset by crisis, economic, social, and ecological. How we understand those crises has great bearing on how we organize, and how we think about the future of possible worlds beyond the present order similarly molds the ways we come together collectively now. Marxist theorist Anna Cecilia Dinnerstein's work revolves precisely around these questions. How should we understand capitalism, and how should we think about the not yet, our hopes for a post-capitalist future? Originally from Argentina, she teaches in the Department of Social and Policy Studies at the University of Bath in the UK. Her writings include The Politics of Autonomy in Latin America, The Act of Organizing Hope, and Social Sciences for Another Politics, Women Theorizing Without Parachutes. When I spoke to Anna Dinnerstein last month, I asked her about the tradition of Marxism that she comes out of.
Yes, so I belong to a tradition of Marxism called open Marxism. And this is a tradition that started in the late 80s and 90s when there were three volumes published by Werner Bonnefeld in the UK and Richard Gann and Cosmas Sikopedis from Greece. And the idea of open Marxism is to actually open the categories of Marxism and make Marxism a theory of struggle and not a theory of the laws of accumulation of how capitalism works. So it's basically relocating the categories in the struggle itself. And all started with a book called Open Marxism in German by Agnoli and Mandel, where they were having a debate about whether Marxism was another political economy or an economic approach. And Agnoli was saying no, that Marxism is a critique of political economy, which actually is a subtitle of Capital, sure. A critique of political economy. So for me, open Marxism is an approach that frees, as John Holloway says, tries to free Marx from these Marxisms that are a more orthodox or structuralist, like Althusser and people like that.
Do you feel like there has been, especially since the disintegration of the Soviet Union, a real rethinking and revisiting of Marxism that has allowed for the flourishing of many more perspectives, including the one you're mentioning?
Yes, that is the context for open Marxism. But I would say that despite the crisis of the Soviet Union and what happened after, we still have orthodox Marxism available for everyone who likes that. So I would say yes, it gave the opportunity to open up the categories and rethink Marx. In fact, there is a journal that is published here, which is is called Rethinking Marxism. Open Marxism belongs to Capital and Class and the Conference of the Socialist Economies. There is a tradition there. So I think the open Marxist tradition takes from there and from many authors from the past that had been, put aside or neglected or on purpose, not considered. So, I think there was an opening of rethinking for obvious reasons. Yes.
Which leads me to a question about how you see the current moment, because clearly part of that rethinking, partly it's to do with the orthodoxy of the Soviet Union and the lock it sort of had on what Marxism was and what it wasn't. But also the neoliberal era has thrown a lot of things upside down, and getting a grip on the moment or the times we're living in has been sometimes challenging. And I wanted to ask you how you see this time, including those assumptions that I think had been sort of fundamental to Marxism about the agency of the working class in remaking society and leading to a society after capitalism. How do you see the working class in this moment? And more broadly, how do you understand these times? A very big question.
Yes, a very big question. So neoliberalism, of course, or global neoliberalism is the name for the complete reconstitution of capital accumulation. So clearly, in different countries work differently, but the main idea behind is to, in the discourse, is to come back to the market. In fact, I mean, the market cannot be understood without the state. You know, for example, I'm not an expert in the U.S. economics, but Bush, President Bush, had a lot of, you know, protectionism as it Trump's. So Trump's policies. So it is more discursively in many ways, you know, the defeat of the working class. It's so the discourse and the imaginary of, you know, disempower the working class. Now, of course, for example, Margaret Thatcher introduced 14 pieces of legislation to regulate labor that we are still, you know, using to diminish and destroy the power of the working class. So that was really, really hard. And I think in addition to the deindustrialization or moving onto financial sector, I'm talking about UK perhaps, but Germany is much more industrialized. But the fact is that, yes, this idea that the working class is the subject of revolution was called into question for many reasons. And but I think I take working class as an identity. In fact, lots of people might not feel that they belong to the working class, but the concept of class still works because we should refer more to the proletariat, perhaps. So they dispossess the proletariat. And the key feature for me, capitalism, is that the social reproduction of life is subordinated to the rule of money, not as the means of exchange, not money as a form of, you know, trading or, you know, purchasing things, but as the most abstract form of capitalist property. So really that people don't have a job or don't feel like they are part of the working class is not, it is problematic in terms of the subjectivity, who is the one, the subject who's going to lead anything. But we have now struggles that I call the politics of social reproduction around issues of social reproduction, housing, water, depending what we are talking about. The global south, of course, is they are essential needs. And those are, these movements are constituting new subjects, and it's very plural. And it's plural, it's ecological, it's democratic. And I think the change will come from there, as well as the working class. Don't forget that we had a new working class being formed in India, China, and South Africa. 180 million people were on strike around 3 years ago in India, most of them women. 180 million. It's like three UKs. So there is a working class. But there was a lot of debate about subjectivity, who is the subject. So I think we need to put production and social reproduction together. So we're still working on this. It's a very important issue. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if you could speak more about that and those categories for those who aren't familiar with it. Production, you're obviously talking about what takes place in the paid workplace.
Yeah.
Obviously, the iconic image is the factory, but for a lot of people, their workplaces might look different than that. And then social reproduction, what does that look like and how is it useful to see them as linked?
Yes. Well, production, everybody understands, of course, could be knowledge, could be, other types of industry. But we think is people who, in a wage, with a wage producing something. When we talk about social reproduction, we have to think, usually we thought about it as a feminist concept used for the feminist movement, talking about, you know, the work done at home or with the children, raising children. But recently, the social reproduction feminism had worked a lot on a broader concept of social reproduction. We consider the institutions, the legislations, the cultures that make the reproduction of life really happen. So the connection is key. So this separation between production and social reproduction is historical. So I think it's in a crisis at the moment. Why? Because you can have a little job somewhere very precarious, and at the same time you are looking after the children of the whole the part of the neighborhood you live when the other mothers go to work, because you can have a job, but then in the evening you do another thing that is also related to the reproduction of life, like education, for example, pedagogical, you know, meetings, so teaching languages as we see in indigenous communities. So for Marx and for radical thinkers, production and social reproduction belong together. Why? Simple. The analysis of what happens in the labor market doesn't, or in labor in general, should not start with the moment in which we sell our labor power, we get a job, because the question is why we work in the first place and what happened before. So if we don't have the basic needs solved, covered, we cannot come back to work next day. So in order for us to come back to work and have a job, we had to be able to reproduce ourselves. But also, Marx says the worker belongs to capital before she or he gets a job, because we're already dispossessed. So this is where the analysis starts. Then we can see now that some people have a job, a proper job, in the north mainly and in other countries, but the majority of the world population doesn't have a proper job. There is a crisis of social reproduction. But that doesn't mean that class doesn't exist anymore, because the most important thing is that even if we don't have a job, we still need money to reproduce ourselves. And yeah.
Well, then how does bringing social reproduction and struggles at the site of production together shape the possibilities of social movements?
Because the connection between social movements and social reproduction, I think it's important not to separate what social movements do today, because I think there's a big change in social movement action, not to separate what they are doing from labor, issues related to the necessities, the needs that need to be covered for every person. So social movements at the moment are working around issues of social reproduction. That's why with my co-author Harry Pitts, we call it the politics of social reproduction. So you have movements, as I said, working with homelessness, working with, you know, education, working with care, all sorts of things that are related to that area that needs to be covered in order to have the labor market working and people at work. So yeah, it's interesting. Not all social movements, of course. There might be social movements that are demanding something to the state, or that are more specifically connected to an issue. But I think it is important to bring this idea of the social movements working with issues of social reproduction to understand the importance of them.
I'm speaking with critical theorist and sociologist Anna Cecilia Dienerstein. She's the author of The Politics of Autonomy in Latin America, The Art of Organizing Hope. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, as I just mentioned, you have written a book where the subtitle is The Art of Organizing Hope. And I wondered if you can talk about the importance of hope in social movements. And hope, particularly in a North American context or United States context, is kind of a vacuous term because it was used by Obama as a sort of empty gesture toward the future. Why is hope something we should be struggling over?
Okay. Yes, Obama has used it, but many politicians, Martin Luther King as well, and the Pope talks about hope. And Tsipras in Greece, he talked about hope. And so hope is a concept that people use, you know, common sense kind of things. So we think, we hope that something happens. I hope it rains. And for example, and I hope that this or that politician wins. The way in which I am using hope is as a category of struggle, I would say. So for Ernst Bloch, my inspiration, hope is an emotion that helps us to throw ourselves to what we belong to, he says, right? Once we learn hope, we educate hope, we can actually anticipate right here and now in the present what we would think is the better future. So because we are doing it right now with other people collectively, it is the possibility, we are open up the possibility to do something different, is connected to praxis, is actually a praxis-oriented activity, as Ruth Levitas says. So hope is not just a feeling of waiting for something, despite in the dictionary you might find that is an expectation that something happens or something like that. But actually, for Bloch, is the capacity of humanity, of humans, to actually occupy an empty space that he calls the not yet reality, which is material, but it doesn't have any form. So to give form of that possibility is what we do when we have hope. We jump onto that kind of empty space, so to speak, to create something that doesn't exist yet.
And of course, Ernst Bloch was an early 20th century German Marxist philosopher. But his category that you just mentioned, hope as connected to the not yet, could that not apply equally to a reactionary hopes, right-wing hopes for the future and a reactionary agenda for the future as much as it could for a radical left-wing one?
It could, but because Bloch is a Marxist philosopher, as you said, I mean, he became a Marxist late in his life, but he is for radical social change. So to answer that question, what I would say, my view, is that the not yet, and it sounds a little bit abstract, there is a struggle.
Sounds like a translation from German.
Yes. There is a struggle over the meaning of the not yet. So if we have a right-wing politician or movement trying to occupy that with violence, for example, I think there might be some kind of contention and antagonism or struggle that we cannot see. But who is going to occupy this future now? And this is why sometimes we get disappointed, which is a very important concept in Bloch's philosophy. He says hope should be disappointable, because otherwise there's no hope. It will finish there when we get there. So, yeah, I mean, it is a tricky question, and there is a debate whether they have dreams, you know, the right had dreams and utopias as well. I think yes, but we are trying to figure out how to transform the world radically for the good. So I think there is a struggle over that. And the neoliberal, for me, the neoliberal was utopia. And they found a moment in a crisis in the 70s, and they, you know, they actually occupied that empty space, and there was a crisis of the left. So this is a good example of how it happened. That dream of the right, that it was kind of impossible, improbable, but it happened. And so, yes, we need to be stronger and try to occupy those spaces that they are not yet.
Well, tell us more about that. In the 1970s, as you say, the right came forward with their ideas, which were certainly iconoclastic at the time against the mainstream liberal centrist establishment, economic orthodoxy, etc. Why were they able to occupy that space? I mean, is this a war of ideas? In that case, the left lost it?
I think the ideas actually complement what is happening, in general in a crisis. I think there are many interpretations of the crisis of the 70s, and a lot of people talk about the petrol crisis, etc. All that comes together. My interpretation, that is not only mine, I share with other people, is that what happened in the 70s, that the labor was empowered. Then unions, in different ways, even in the UK, where, its unions are not that politicized as, for example, compared to France, they were having a say in many things. And also, because of the full employment of the welfare, of the Keynesian policies, there was a lot of turnover, there was a lot of union organization, a lot of power. And I think what happened is that became too expensive. And then the capitalists started to kind of withdraw, bring in machinery, but also there was a good moment for getting rid of Bretton Woods. So in 71, Nixon reverted the Bretton Woods. So this was a moment in which all different currencies started being in the market and, struggling against each other.
This is when Nixon took the dollar off the gold standard.
Yes. Because the Bretton Woods system had been an agreement after the war to reconstruct Europe. So, and that is the beginning of everything, really. The euro market, dollar in London, and offshore banking. And transnational corporations existed from long time ago, I would say end of the 1800s, but that they found the opportunity there. And I think the deregulation of labor and the destruction of trade unions comes as part of that. So we go from Keynesianism to monetarism, it's an interpretation. Having said that, these are two ways in which the state deals with crisis. Because if you really analyze the policies, they are mixed, as we said before. There was protectionism in the state always, no matter who governs. So
So
we had to relativize. But definitely now what we have is an argument for let's keep money in place, because we can't just keep on going as it was, because there's no regulation. And then of course, the unions are blamed for hyperinflation, etc. And I think then that is the match. Those ideas that they have been cultivating for a long time in Chicago and everywhere, they start coming together. And then they start also coming to the South, where the Washington Consensus, where they blame the populist governments in the South to have been, mismanaging money.
You're meaning the Global South.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so it all comes together. But I think the core of the neoliberalism is that crisis of the management of labor, really, and a moment in which, money becomes deregulated and everybody had to be subordinated. And the state becomes really the tool to control labor and bring, the money, capture the money.
Well, now in the years we're living through, that the system that was put in place in the 1970s, neoliberalism, also seems to be in crisis. How would radicals occupy that space that you're arguing that needs to be fought over, that space of the not yet, of hope of the future, while neoliberalism seems pretty bankrupt in terms of ideas, in terms of institutions and the dynamics of the system, it's certainly still going. How would we push back and fight for something different in this sort of, on the train you're describing?
It's complicated. It's tricky. I think there is a big crisis of the left that is not recovered yet. Lack of imagination as well. And as Jerome Roos says, in a magazine, it's called Roar Magazine, and I really like what he says. He says there is a dual crisis. One is, crisis of imagination, and the other crisis is that the left is not able to bury the dead and just start again, right? So we have all this problem, and I think the right is occupying this space. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a non-mainstream left to compete with what is happening with the discourse of course, Trump, but also even Putin, Salvini. We can mention many of them, and these are all men, white, or and this taking the worst out of people. And people put up with that because they think that things are going okay. And actually they are, because they don't have to actually be democratic or find different ways of telling things or treat people, you know, or respect well or respect the institutions. So I think we are in trouble. And the other problem is that what we have the left is okay, but it's not really something to die for, institutionally speaking. It is okay, but my fear is that it's not going to be enough against the innovation of the far right, or the, I would say, the far right that is now the right. Because Farage in the UK was really far right. They were like, you know, anytime they were speaking somewhere, we had to call the police because it was all horrible. And they had this, all these web pages saying that the Holocaust didn't exist and terrible things about people of color or women, etc. And now, you know, a little bit thanks to the media and liberals who thought that we had to let them talk, and there's a problem there, I understand, but so they became really completely institutionalized. And we have that Farage actually led the politics of the UK. We are out of the European Union thanks to Farage.
Right. This is Nigel Farage, UKIP, the right-wing party that was pushing Brexit.
Yes.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'm joined today by Anna Cecilia Dinnerstein. She is originally from Argentina, but teaches in the Department of Social and Policy Sciences at the University of Bath in the UK. And she is the author of a number of books, including The Politics of Autonomy in Latin America. Well, I want to ask you about one of the things that you mentioned in this moment of crisis, which is the crisis of the left's imagination. How do you describe that crisis? What's lacking, and what might be necessary to bring the imagination back to bear?
It's a very difficult question. When I say the lack of imagination, is that not simply because some of the policies that the institutional left is pushing for are kind of old, but I don't oppose the welfare state at all. I love the NHS, the National Health Service in the UK. I think the lack of imagination is, for me, this incapacity to start thinking in a different way about politics altogether. Not simply incorporating women or listening to the movements, but really start thinking, what is the role of a government of the left? There's something I've been thinking about prefiguration. When we talk about social movements, we talk about how people at the grassroots try to prefigure alternate realities. And I'm thinking about something like prefigurative translation. So the state always translates what's happened at the grassroots. Let's say people are organizing factory occupations, as we had in Argentina in the 90s with the crisis 2001, and the state appropriated that. And when the government was on the left, Kirchner, Nestor Kirchner came, then it was better because the factories belong almost to his program of helping, you know, the labor market and people to get jobs. If someone is taking the factory because they don't want to be unemployed, what is wrong with that? So they became institutionalized. So I call that translation. But if you don't have a prefigurative translation, inevitably the government will de-radicalize the movement. So for me, if there is a government on the left, say Sanders, or it was going to be Corbyn, but it couldn't, it should be really pay attention not to do that. But would they? Because they still have the problem of being, you know, the government in a country among many countries, and they need to keep things, you know, in control. So it is a tension what we work. But definitely, I mean, try to figure out what is politics. And we always fight for the to destroy the separation between civil society and the state, because the political is not only in the state. But at the moment, you know, even if they are on the left, they are the focus of attention and the political, the politicians. And what's happening at the grassroots, it depends where. In some places there's not much development. Where there is not a good translation. So it would be to start with to think of politics in a different way.
Well, following up on that, what do you think the relationship of social movements to the state should be? Certainly in the United States, for quite a long period following the 60s, there was a focus on social movements, prefigurative politics, working outside the state, often with a much smaller left. And in recent years, the ranks of people who are interested in, let's just say broadly, progressive politics has increased. But a lot of that has been around electoral politics. Mm. Bernie Sanders has been particularly a focus of a lot of that. Of course, there's not just one left, but how quite a few people on the left have seen the state has shifted. Mm. How do you think a radical project should see the state as a place to struggle?
Mm-hmm. So the state is not a thing or only an arena where we can, you know, fight for resources and institutions to be created. I think the state is a political form of something else, of the capital relations. So that form can change. But in my view, our focus should be to produce change. And the ideas come from, you know, the movements and people. Not necessarily movements. It could be, you know, NGOs, it could be neighbors, it could be mobilized, or societies in movement, as Raul Sivecci calls it. It's a nice term. You don't need necessarily to be in a social movement, but you are mobilized, right? And some societies are more mobilized than others. So I think the question is not whether, you know, we should use the state or take power of the state, as, you know, John Holloway proposed once in a famous book, can we change the world without taking power? For me, the question is, how do we deal with the state? Because the state, I consider it to be a mediation of class struggle or the movement struggle. It will always mediate. Because if we strike, there is a regulation for the strike. If we are women in the streets, there might be something related to the programs that, you know, there are for women. There's always... It's an impossibility, in my view, to be outside the state. So for me, the important thing is the tension that exists, the contradiction when you say no to something and then you start creating something in the community and then the state comes, either the police to repress or someone comes and says, okay, let's institutionalize that. How do you deal with these contradictions? And I think that has to be discuss at the grassroots. It cannot be discussed at the top, because at the top they have other things in mind and they had to be under pressure. So if Sanders is in power or Corbyn would have been in power or others, we need to keep an eye on them as movements. And this is what happens in Greece. In Greece, I thought that was going to happen. But then went wrong.
Syriza.
That was a huge mobilization, but it's a long story, but because of the coalition, there was the right, the left, and because of the situation with the European Union, you know, and what happened with the debt, etc., it didn't happen. Some people say it was a betrayal, but the society was really mobilized, putting all the hope in the state. And it's fine, but I don't think that we need to do that anymore. We should be cautious and think, okay, but, you know, this is where we create what we want and then see how you are going to translate it in a way that we can compromise, but that it happens. So it's shifting, really, the focus and think how we can protect what we are doing, and also... What is the excess or the surplus that people create that sometimes it doesn't translate in a legislation or in a political speech or in a candidate, choosing a candidate? It's more about other issues like experiences, feelings, recovering certain capacity to, you know, to stand up and say no. Lots of things that are crucial for any process of transformation, but they are always like diminished. Because we always get, what did you achieve? So also to create our own measurement of success. Perhaps, you know, it's something that mobilizes people emotionally and change their life forever. And that is success. But they can see it. So if we use the same tools to measure success, we will not realize what we did well for the next one.
How do you see ambitions changing in practice? You know, you're talking about the need to hold our leaders or the people who are the leaders of the left, maybe they're ours, maybe they're not, to keep them accountable. And I think for a lot of people on the left, they have oscillated between moments of hope and total hopelessness and despair. And so it's very tricky to kind of keep a grip on hope. And so, and in terms of holding people accountable, that or even pressuring to do that, often I think people at this point, at least in the United States, don't even feel like they actually have the social power to sway things to the left at this point, or enough to the left. There's a real lack of confidence about the ability to actually have a mass-based movements on the left, even though, you know, those have increased in recent years. They're still small, and it comes after many decades of defeat. And then on top of that, I should say, I think we're living in very despairing times because of the climate emergency. There are a lot of things that make people hopeless. How do you see movements sort of holding on to that future orientation and projection into the not yet, the hopeful idea that we could really radically change things in such sort of precarious and uncertain times?
Yeah, I mean, it is about praxis, about the practical thing. So I think this is it. The first, the hopelessness. Of course, we have this environmental crisis, and it is clear that the ice is melting. But there is also the fact that in many other moments, it was really, really terrible. The world was in a terrible state. So for Bloch, hope is exactly necessary at this moment. So when people say, well, you're talking about hope, but look at the state of the world. And I say, precisely, when am I going to talk about hope? When everything is okay. So the thing is how to hold on to that. If we see hope as a tool of struggle, I think lots of people are doing fantastic things, projects, you know, creating new ways that will have to be incorporated into any policy that tries to save the planet, because there are several dynamics at the moment around the climate crisis, for example. So experiments of all kinds of housing, energy, and all sorts of things that come from movements that they are doing fantastic job. When there was an event in Ghent in Belgium in 2018, in November 2018, called The Art of Organizing Hope, and it was activists, there were 90 activists in that alternative summit, and all of them belong to different communities doing different things. It was really fantastic to see that, and we discussed all these projects together. There were all sorts of things, like different forms of, you know, communal living, as I said, energy, food. Food is very important, and they're experimenting with everything. So this is one thing, so the practical thing, regardless of the rhetoric. Because I think also, so the second thing will be the language. We don't have a language, a new one. People think, oh, the left, you know, what are they going to say? Class. It doesn't matter whether class exists or not, I believe it does. The Zapatista movement in Mexico, the uprising of the Zapatistas in 94 was key, because they came with the issue of dignity, for example. Dignity, then it was taken by Seattle, the movement in 99. I think it's important. So I'm not saying this should be, but terms, you know, words like that, ideas that we can hold on to create new terms, new languages, new ways of understanding what's happening, because the old left doesn't have that. And that's, I think the right has innovated in this respect, and is very determined to get to the point. And I am sure that people would like to hear something different, and they will, I think, will follow. But at the moment, there is nothing on offer. I cannot think. There are many movements, they are interesting, but we don't have, perhaps it will not happen that it will be universal again. But I think the most universal we have, or pluriversal, is the Zapatistas discourse. that there are many worlds and all of them should, you know, coexist in the world, and we are all oppressed, and what we are searching for is for dignity of humanity. And for blogs, humanity is a project, it's an unfinished project, and the search for, he says, we are not there yet. So these kind of ideas, you know, need to be put in a language that is understood, understandable, and then, yeah, mobilize with that, because otherwise, I don't think we're going to be able to present an alternative to the right that is now winning ideologically, emotionally, and is creating a lot of nasty conflicts in society, hatred.
I'm speaking with Anna Cecilia Dinnerstein. She is a critical theorist and sociologist, originally from Argentina. She's based at the University of Bath in the UK. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. You know, we were describing that there is a multiplicity of projects that people are engaged in all over the place. And a lot of this could be described as prefigurative, different ways for housing, different ways to live more ecologically. And yet, those kinds of projects have been going on for decades without projecting themselves or amassing the kind of numbers to turn into something that is oriented toward the future. And often, actually, prefigurative politics can at times just get bogged down in just being about the present, actually, you know, and a smaller group of people living a certain way in the present rather than in the future. Is there a way to get around that pitfall? Because often, rather than looking like a model of something that a lot of people want to join to, they can seem kind of subcultural. This is what some people are up to, and, you know, you're not really invited anyway.
Yes, true. Yeah, that's the thing. So to see this as, particularly at this moment, I think there is an opportunity. Unfortunately, it's an opportunity of a big crisis, but big, like, is scary to see that, you know, this environmental crisis. But I think, again, I would call these critical affirmations, for example, critical affirmations in the age of destruction, right? So we are, I don't know who is we had to discuss the we, but if we start thinking, the left in general, how to name these different alternatives and just create some kind of, I'm not saying coordination, but some kind of understanding or index of the things that people are doing, are inventing, and a survey, for example. I know someone in India that has collected like 800 projects, and they call it like the tapestry, like waving alternative forms of society. These kind of things, if we can expand, and we will give the importance that they have. What you are referring to is something that in the UK, some people call it folk politics. And that's why I call it the politics of social reproduction, because folk politics is like very nice. They mobilize, they plant, you know, tomatoes. But the real thing, you know, the real thing is elsewhere. But I think that's changing. The real thing is not elsewhere now. And maybe transnational corporations will have to comply to do what, you know, it has been created somewhere, but obviously reproduce at a bigger scale, because otherwise we're all going to die. So that kind of thing, I mean, that's why I say unfortunately, but we need to kind of give the importance and fight against this idea that this is lifestyle stuff. Some of them are, but some of them are really political. I know lots of people working in this. So I think academia could be a good place, the media as well.
Let me end by asking you about the universal basic income. It's an idea that we've heard a lot about on the right. In fact, there are quite a few people on the right here in the Bay Area and Silicon Valley who are concerned that automation will lead to perhaps unruly, massive unemployed people. So to have a kind of basic stipend that people get every month, whether or not they have a job, might be a desirable option. But there's also a left version of it, and some of its proponents have been arguing that to have a universal basic income would be a good thing to get the world off of a lot of needless production, you know, in a world of climate crisis, and away obviously from alienated work. Tell us why you think a universal basic income is not a great strategy for the left.
I think the universal basic income is not a good strategy for the left or a good utopia for the left, for a simple reason that, of course, is debatable, but that what the universal basic income would do is to distribute money by the state and is tackling the issue of social reproduction. So, in fact, I don't see how the state and money, the two most important forms of subordination, can be desirable. How can the left can decide that the state distributes money? So first, I don't find there are many, I mean, we don't have time to describe, there are many options for the universal basic income. And I don't oppose in a situation where people don't have any other means. But I think the fact that the universal basic income has been discussed by the left and is discussed in Davos as well, means that what is being trying to replace is the wage. Now, people think instead of a wage, they will get universal basic income, but the wage doesn't pay for what they think they pay. The wage, in fact, is a representation of the power of money. So my opposition is simply that I think if the most important feature of capitalism is the subordination of human reproduction or social reproduction in general to the rule of money, why would I support the distribution of money, or free money as they call it, the massive distribution of money by the state? Now, in these proposals for the left, there is an expectation that there will be Sanders who distributes the money. But if you look at India, Modi, he's using really the universal basic income as a repressive measure. It's not really what we are dreaming for. So I think it's complicated. As I said, if this is a proposal that comes from the government, the left, perhaps we need to think about it, to propose that this is the utopia for the left, automation, and this is accelerationism, push for automation and the universal basic income, and also reduce labor hours. I agree with that, you know, to fight to work less. And then go on holidays. It sounds a bit like selling, you know, something. Work less, more leisure, something like that. I don't think it's serious, because we still are subordinated to money. We need money. And also there's a confusion in my view that is the fact that if we don't work, and this is coming back to the discussion of production and social reproduction minutes ago, if we don't work doesn't mean that we are not workers anymore and we don't need money anymore. That's why the universal basic income will cover. And this is the problem, that we live in a system that we need to work in order to live. And this is a very strong idea, because as we said, you know, we belong to capital before we get a job, and we will continue belonging to capital because it will be the state distributing money. And the confusion is, from a productivist perspective, if we don't work and we get the money and don't work, then this post-work is post-capitalism. It's a way to post-capitalism. But capitalism is not about putting people to work. We need to tackle all the institutions and all the forms that make that possible, including the reproduction of life through money. It sounds complicated, but the logic is not there. This conversation is not there. So there is no straight line from no work, post-capitalism. Maybe we will not work anymore, or few people will work. We'll still have capitalism.
Do you also have the concern that if we found ourselves in a post-work world that was not a post-capitalist world, that those of us who do have waged work would be giving up the social power that comes with work?
Yeah, it's a liquidation of class of struggles, labor struggles. I don't think it will empower people. There is an argument that people will get empowered because they don't have to go to work. So they will get this money for free and then will do really, they all become activists. I see the other way around. I think when you work, you still have a trade union or not, but you will fight for it, and then you have something to negotiate. I mean, the universal basic income, first, the amount of money will be minimal, but also we risk that they will cut other services with the argument that we have the universal basic income. And also, I don't see the power to the contradictions and the power to fight for, you know, to enter into conflict will not be there. So I don't know why people who propose universal basic income think that people will mobilize instead of be demobilized.
We'll have to leave it right there. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much.
Anna Cecilia Dienerstein has been my guest. She is the author of a number of books, including The Politics of Autonomy in Latin America, The Art of Organizing Hope. She is an editor of the most recent edition of Open Marxism. She teaches in the Department of Social and Policy Studies at the University of Bath in the UK. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.